Everyone. It's a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Lauren O'Donnell, who's with Dr. Golby's Surgical Brain Mapping Laboratory at Harvard Medical School. One of the themes today that you've seen is that there's many different representations of DTI data, and really a lot of methods can be applied to distill either high-dimensional representations of the signal or track geometry. Carl Frederick mentioned this morning many methods to look at distilling tracts from DTI data. On the other hand, though, once you have tracts, you have to decide what to do a population study. And so it's an extremely non-trivial problem how you would cluster the tracts that you get in an individual subject into sort of meaningful elements that you could average or do statistics on across subjects. And also, given the interest in parametric representations for tracts and building vector spaces and so forth, you'd really like to be able to build reference frames and coordinate systems on these tracts that would allow you to do inference and population studies. So it's a great pleasure to introduce Laura and think about some of these issues today. Thanks for coming.
Present some joint work with Dr. Golby and with Carl Frederick Weston, who's up here at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Med School. So the general goal of my work is to analyze white matter within regions that have some anatomical meaning. And so I've chosen to use fiber tracts, which are the major white matter bundles in the brain. And these images are pictures from Gray's Anatomy, which are showing some fiber tracts that actually have names, like the arcuofasciculus, the uncinate, and I'm going to explain a little bit more about those next. Oh. Here we go. We're in progress here. Okay, the space bar. No, here we go. Oh, there we go. Too far. Okay. So the overall approach... Initially, we need to find these white matter structures that we're interested in. So that's a segmentation problem. And we'd also like to do quantitative analysis. And there are two main ways to do that, either in the entire tract, the whole tract, or along the tract, sort of a cross-sectional or point-wise method. But before I really get into the method, I'm going to give some background for those of you who might be interested in starting DTI. So the overall outline of my talk, first I'll give an overview of white matter anatomy, then an overview of some background on DTI, and then finally I'll get to the white matter segmentation and the quantitative analysis parts. On to the anatomy. So the most basic, important unit to know about in the white matter would be the neuron, and of course they send and receive information. And the white matter is white because of the myelination on the axon of the neuron. And the gray matter contains the cell bodies of these neurons. In general, the gray matter can also contain entire, very small neurons, but the larger neurons that we're talking about actually being able to have any information about from DTI have their cell bodies in gray matter, which can either be in the cortex or in the subcortical gray matter. And then their axons travel through the white matter, and finally at the end of the axon, they synapse onto some other cell body, which is in the gray matter. So these white matter fiber tracts that we're talking about, on the left, this is an actual white matter dissection that some anatomists very painstakingly did with an actual human brain. And this, I've been informed, took days. And on the right, we have an example of one of these fiber tracts that we're interested in. And the reason that I have this slide up here is basically that on the left, it looks like these fiber tracts extend, for example, from point A to point B and are very perfect units that you can imagine segmenting easily. But on the right, and this image was drawn by an anatomist actually here in California, Jim Fallon, on the right you see that axons actually enter and leave the cingulum bundle all along its length. So there are multiple types of fiber tracts. Some fiber tracts are sort of cohesive bundles that go from A to B and start and end. And then other fiber tracts are more like superhighways that axons jump on and off of. So it's important to keep this in mind when you're thinking about what the data means. So a little more detail on white matter anatomy. Now, why would any of you care about the white matter anatomy? Maybe you're all mathematicians, and so it's not very interesting to you. So the reason that I would say that it's worthwhile caring about the anatomy is that if you have some result like this, which this is a result in three subjects of the automatic white matter segmentation, you'd like to actually know if this is remotely correct without having to beg a doctor to come and look at all of your data. And so the take-home message from this is that it's very three-dimensional. These are views from the left side, and these are views from the bottom, inferior views. And so you can see, for example, the corpus callosum here in sort of a bright blue-purple is medial, so it's sort of in the top middle of this image. And here you can see from underneath, it's sort of extending in the center. And there are all of these other tracts that are, this green tract is lateral to, for example, this orange tract. And it's important to have some sense of what's happening in three dimensions, in my opinion. So the main fiber tract types, there are three types. There are association tracts, which connect cortical regions within one hemisphere. There are projection tracts, which can connect cortical regions to subcortical gray matter or to the spinal cord. And then there are the commissural tracts that actually cross the hemispheres, and they normally connect homologous or related cortical regions in both hemispheres. This is an overview of some of the selection of association tracts that we can actually find and are interested in with tractography. So this image here is from Gray's Anatomy, and it looks very 2D, which is why I had that picture on the previous page. It looks like everything's been smushed into one plane, even though really the cingulum is more medial, more in the center, and the uncinate fasciculus is more lateral or out to the side. So the uncinate fasciculus here connects the frontal and temporal lobes. The arcuate fasciculus is part of the superior longitudinal fasciculus here, and that's thought to be involved in language. Then there's the cingulum bundle, which is just above the corpus callosum and runs anterior, posterior, and it's part of the limbic system and actually has a C shape that curves around quite far. And then finally, the fornix is also part of the limbic system. You can't see that here. And in the lower right, this is the image of the fornix from Gray's Anatomy, but it's a bit confusing because it has a completely different orientation. So when you actually do tractography and clustering in these regions, you get things that look like this, where this is the cingulum bundle in purple, and the fornix is this thing in green that wraps around sort of superior to it. And then you get the arcuate fasciculus looks something like this, and the uncinate something like this. So there are basically a whole lot of C-shaped structures that look kind of similar but have relatively complex 3D relationships. Next we have the projection tracts. This is an artist's rendering of what basically the corona radiata looks like. And this is from Jim Fallon, who's the anatomist that I know, who actually gave names to all of the different regions. Now, a lot of times if you see a paper about tractography, it'll just say the corona radiata, as if it's this entire structure. But it's actually not. The term corona radiata only refers to this yellow part, which is relatively superior. Below that, there's the internal capsule, and below that, there's cerebral peduncles. And so this is interesting, something that you might standardly get in a subject if you do single tensor tractography in this region might look something like this. And as you can see with the tractography, there's absolutely no clear division of what these different regions might be. So it's a little bit hard to know how to name it, which is why a lot of people just call this corona radiata. And then another interesting thing to note, in the upper right, this is now a view from the front, an anterior view, it's a coronal image. This is another image from Gray's Anatomy, and this one is showing the motor tract. And something also important to note for tractography is that the motor tract actually descends from the cortex, but not just from right here where you usually see it starting in tractography. It starts all along the cortex, all in this region, and it sort of has this fan shape, and that's very difficult for most tractography methods to capture. Finally, the main commissural tract that we're all relatively familiar with is the corpus callosum. And this is another picture from Gray's Anatomy, what it looks like from a superior view. And this is an example of what it might look like with tractography. In this example, it has different clusters that are colored different colors for different regions of it. And this is a view from the left. as opposed to a view from the top. There's also the anterior commissure, which is so small that with single sensor tractography, it's sort of an invisible fiber tract. And also, if anybody has any questions, feel free. Next, I'll give a brief overview, simple DTI background. So first of all, I think we're all starting to be quite familiar with the fact that diffusion MRI measures water diffusion, and that it somehow gives an approximate orientation for the fibers in the voxel. And sort of a simple way to think about it is if you have a lot of axons all aligned, you measure faster diffusion along the fiber and slower diffusion across the fiber. And this isn't just because of myelination, because you see this diffusion anisotropy, higher this direction, lower this direction, that's anisotropy. You see that even in neonate brains that don't really have myelin. And so it's likely due to the presence of the cell membranes. So the diffusion tensor MRI model is something developed by Peter Basser in 1994. It's a 3x3 symmetric positive definite matrix. And the typical simplistic way to think of this is that it is a fiber coordinate system. I say simplistic because we've all heard a lot today about how the single tensor can't possibly represent a lot of the fiber configurations that actually exist in the brain. But the simple way to get a handle on what it means is to think of it as a fiber coordinate system where the major eigenvector is aligned with the axons, and that's the principal diffusion direction. So once you have these diffusion tensors, you can actually find in the brain, and these are actually example tensors from different locations in the brain, you can see lots of different diffusion shapes and magnitudes. So this is a visualization of what tensors look like with varying degrees of diffusion anisotropy. On the left, this blue tensor has low anisotropy. It's similar in shape to a sphere. The one in the middle has a bit higher anisotropy because it's more of a planar shape. And then finally, on the right, this yellow one has high anisotropy. It's more like a cigar shape. So in diffusion tensor MRIs, what's actually commonly used in clinical studies are scalar invariants, which are scalar quantities that you can calculate at every voxel from the diffusion tensor. And they're called invariants because they're invariant to coordinate system transformations. They're invariant to rotation or translation of the object, like your head and MRI magnet. And they quantify diffusion shapes and magnitudes. So one is the trace, which is just the sum of the eigenvalues, and a related popular one is the mean diffusivity, which is the average of the eigenvalues. And there's also the fractional anisotropy, which is a normalized variance, which quantifies how dissimilar is the diffusion from a sphere. So how unlike a sphere is it, which is why the fractional anisotropy can be high in both planar regions and more cigar-shaped regions. And finally, almost done with our DTI overview. This image in the upper right is a very standard visualization of the major eigenvector and the fractional anisotropy. So what it is it's colored, the right anterior, superior, or XYZ coordinates of the major eigenvector are represented at each voxel by a color. So that means that left-right pointing eigenvectors are red, superior, inferior, blue, and the ones going into the plane that are anterior-posterior, those ones look green. And the brightness of the color is modulated by the fractional anisotropy, so that in regions with high anisotropy, i.e. the white matter, you can really see these colors and instantly see where the major eigenvector is pointing. So we've heard a lot today about tractography. This is just a method for estimating fiber tract trajectories in the white matter. And so the most common is the streamline method, which is just stepping along the principal diffusion direction. This is a schematic of how that might work. If you started here and you took certain step size, you interpolated the tensor again, you followed its major eigenvector for another step size, interpolated the tensor, followed for the same step size again. And CF, Dr. Weston, has talked a lot about different tractography methods earlier. This is a specific example for those of you who might not be familiar with what the data looks like. This is an example of simple single tensor tractography that was seated at a point in the middle of the corpus callosum. And this is an example of what the tensors actually look like in these little square regions along this fiber. So in this little square here, you can see these are some randomly sampled tensors that are along that trajectory in that region. And you can see they're highly anisotropic, which is why people really like to test their algorithms in the corpus callosum, because it's a very, very nice region for this. As you can see, it extend a little further, and they become more isotropic. And finally, at the end, it becomes clear why you don't want to track in regions with low anisotropy, because these tensors clearly have very little directional information. So onto the potentially more interesting part. The challenge with tractography and with diffusion imaging, main challenge, I think, is that the voxel size is in millimeters, but the axon diameters are in microns. So I know CF talked about this earlier. There's this clear scale mismatch between what we can measure and what we're actually interested in. And so as Dr. Murray was saying earlier, the single tensor model isn't sufficient in certain regions, such as, for example, crossing, fanning, or bending. And he also got the kissing region, which is where the fibers come near each other. So the tractography methods are clearly imperfect because of the way they work and because of the data. But this is good for research, right? We have a lot to do. So these are some specific examples now. I have a couple specific examples of what might be considered to be failures in tractography and standard single tensor tractography to motivate those of you who might be working on something better. So this is the cingulum bundle again, which we know has axons entering and leaving it. But if we want to do a cingulum bundle segmentation, the actual anatomical region that's referred to as the cingulum bundle is just the red part. So below here, you can see one of my results in the cingulum bundle region, and you can see that there are a lot of tractography trajectories that are entering and leaving the cingulum. Now, it's not exactly wrong, because we know that anatomically axons enter and leave, but it could be wrong, because it could be that they're just jumping onto the corpus callosum, which is just neighboring. So that's one challenge, how to avoid things like that. Another challenge is, this is the corona radiata again. But as you can see, this is what it's supposed to look like. But it actually gets cut off here because of low anisotropy in these regions and in these regions. Now, these are two different subjects, so you can see this sort of problem is very common. And it's probably due to crossing fibers from other tracts in that region. And so in the voxel, only one can be represented. So there's either low anisotropy or the voxel has another direction and it stops tracking there. Another challenge that I was mentioning earlier is locating the corticospinal tract. So this is a typical streamline tractography result in the area of the corticospinal tract, which is the motor tract. And this is motor fMRI from the foot and the hand and the lip. And as we can see from Gray's anatomy, the corticospinal tract actually should connect more laterally out here to the lip areas and to the hand areas. But very frequently, the connections to foot and perhaps hand are found, but the connections to lip... Oh, did you have a question? Oh, okay. The connections to lip are much, much harder to find. And the main reason is that there are these anterior-posterior fibers running right here that are part of the superior longitudinal fasciculus. So because the tensor model represents one thing, it's difficult to reach there. So we've done some work in CF's lab on trying to use a two-tensor model for this, but it's not even clear if two tensors are enough. And so perhaps some of the work that's been shown earlier today and yesterday about the actual complexity of the data might give a bit of a clue of what sort of model is really needed in this region to actually connect to the lip. Final tractography challenge for single tensor tractography is that it may cross from one structure to another. So you can see right here, it's crossed from what looks like part of the corona radiata onto what's probably part of the SLF, archaeofasciculus. And so you can see this, you expect to see the purple, and you expect to see the yellow, but you don't expect to see this yellow that crossed off into the purple. And so after all that, why am I working on segmentation of tractography? Well, I think you'll see from the results that you do, despite some of its imperfections, find very, very similar regions across subjects. So I think it's a very powerful segmentation tool. And also, most of my methods are general, so if another type of algorithm comes along to produce better trajectories, I can simply plug them in, try it on that. So the white matter segmentation part of the talk. The overall goal here is to go from process diffusion MRI data into these meaningful brain regions that we've been discussing. There's been a lot of work on this. There are two main types of tractography segmentation methods. One would be interactive methods that usually use multiple regions of interest to manually or interactively select tractography. And then there have also been automatic methods proposed, some of which act on part of the brain, some of which act on the whole brain, and some of which include anatomical labeling with information from an atlas. But what we've decided to do is actually take all the data that we have and learn a tractography atlas from the data. So actually learn the structures that are there in the population. This is an overview of what the input data is. We perform tractography in the whole brain, which is in all the voxels in the brain. It produces thousands of trajectories, like normally at least 10,000 per subject. And we'd like to start and stop in the white matter, so we use the linear anisotropy measure, which tells you how much the shape of your tensor is like a cigar. Yes, go ahead.
When you streamline lead, do you start at one point and compute its trajectory, or somehow compute the whole flow together, all together on the image?
So how I do this is you overlay some sort of a grid on the brain. You can either use the voxel centers or a grid every 2 millimeter spacing or something. And at each point on that grid, it's a seed point, and you compute the major eigenvector at that point, and you follow it in both directions.
But
and you
so
continuously step along the direction of the major eigenvector.
But at some point you may meet another voxel in which you started already, so how do you do that?
No, so I don't worry about that at all. It's fine if different things converge in voxels or it doesn't matter. I just each fiber is seeded separately from all other fibers. And then I just get something that looks like that. But certainly they might have more than one in a voxel. So again, we use this linear anisotropy measure for seeding. It's, in our opinion, better than the fractional anisotropy because it's specific to regions where the single tensor model is good, because it looks for things that are a cigar shape, unlike the FA that looks for things that are either planar or a cigar shape. And this is just an image of what does a linear anisotropy mask look like. So as you can see, the yellow clearly is picking out the white matter areas. So an overview of the atlas generation is that we learn common structures, common white matter structures in the population. And the general method, the way it works, is by performing spectral clustering of all subjects together. So take all subjects' brains. We actually register the FA images, but I won't go into detail on that. Then we have whole brain tractography from all subjects in the same coordinate system. And we do clustering on that to look for common structures. So this is an example of the first atlas that I created, where this is the training data. These were 5 subjects, and the colors actually represent the centers of the cluster centroids, and I'll explain that next. And this is the test data, and you can see that this was automatically segmented very similarly to the way the training subjects are segmented. So sort of the driving force behind this, the information that's actually used for clustering, is a pretty simple fiber affinity measure. So it's a pairwise fiber affinity measure based on distances between pairs of closest points on the fibers. So if this is fiber I and this is fiber J, and you want to compute this distance between fiber I and fiber J, simply for every point on fiber I, you find the closest point on fiber J, and that gives you a whole list of these distances. And you take the mean of those distances, and that's your directed distance from fiber I to fiber J. Now, what we don't want a directed distance. We want a distance of the same from fiber I to J and from fiber J to fiber I. So what we do is we compute the distance in both directions, and then we actually use the minimum of those two distances. And the effect of this is to cause pairs of fibers where one fiber might be longer than the other, and one fiber might be shorter. It'll encourage that shorter fiber to group with the longer fiber that it's parallel to. So there won't be a penalty for being a shorter fiber. And this works well across subjects because there is variation in the anatomy as far as some subjects might have a longer tract than other subjects. And so once we have this distance, it gets converted to an affinity just with a Gaussian kernel, and that's the fiber affinity measure. the nice part about this fiber affinity measure, one nice thing about it, is that it's pretty simple to extend it in order to find matches across hemispheres and also in the population. So instead of just using this pairwise distance, we can also reflect the entire brain across the mid-sagittal plane and compute distances between, for each fiber, the distances to all fibers in the unreflected brain and also the distance to all fibers after the reflection of the brain across the mid-sagittal plane. And so that means for each pair of fibers, instead of having two directed distances, you have four possible directed distances, and you just use the minimum of those directed distances and again convert it to an affinity with the Gaussian kernel. So I'm going to hurry through my atlas generation example. This is an example of what the atlas actually looks like. So I said we use spectral embedding, which means that we take this affinity matrix, which is the matrix of all these pairwise affinities that we've calculated, and using its eigenvectors, every fiber is embedded as a point in this space. And this is a toy example, where actually from these fibers, I calculated the affinity matrix, and then using the second through fourth eigenvectors of that affinity matrix, I came up with this embedding that you see right here. And after running clustering in this embedding space, I got four clusters, which then you can see I actually colored in those four clusters up here in this simple tractography example. And after finding the clusters, you can actually look in the brain and see what they actually represent anatomically, and then annotate the atlas, the high-dimensional atlas, which here is only three dimensions, but we use higher dimensions for the actual whole brain. You can actually annotate the atlas with anatomical names. So that's what these names are representing. So I have a toy example, but I'm not going to go through all of the example because I don't think there's time for that. These are just on the right. They're just actual images of these matrices. The affinity matrix, this normalized affinity matrix, because it's a normalized cuts method. The eigenvectors, again, the embedding using the eigenvector matrix. And finally, the clusters. This is slower than it should be. So these are the contents of what we call the high-dimensional atlas. It's in the spectral embedding space. It contains the cluster centroids. It contains the anatomical names. It's high-dimensional. These points are stored in 10 to 20 dimensions. It's definitely not a voxel atlas. And it's created using many subjects, which means we need something called the Nystrom method, which instead of actually computing pairwise affinities between all fibers to all other fibers, which would essentially take days and use up more memory than we have in our computer, we actually approximate the eigenvectors using the eigenvectors of a smaller subproblem. And so then once we have this, we can actually embed new fibers. And so that allows automatic segmentation based on the affinity computation to this subset that I was talking about that we use for the Nystrom method. And so once you embed new trajectories, you basically see which cluster they fall in, and you can transfer the labels. This is just an overview of the overall pipeline. We have all this whole brain tractography from many subjects. We do the cluster analysis that produces the high-dimensional atlas that we augment with anatomical labels. Then when we have a new subject, we run it through the atlas, and we get a segmentation of that new subject. So this is a nice visualization of some of the anatomical structures in this particular atlas, which was constructed with 30 subjects. We've got the corpus callosum, the inferior occipital frontal fasciculus, the occipital temporal fasciculus. We've got some of the cerebellar peduncles, uncinate, arcuate. And these are examples of the results in the training data and the test data. I'm sorry, this was actually calculated with 15 subjects this atlas. So that's the training data, the top 10, and the bottom 5 are the test data that were labeled with the atlas. And this is a nice result because it shows the variability of tractography in this population. So the purple is the arcuate fasciculus, and the orange is the uncinate fasciculus. And so this is a view from the left, and in a lot of subjects you can see both the left and the right side of the arcuate fasciculus. But on this one you can see that it's missing the arcuate fasciculus on the left side. And on this one you can see that it's missing it on the right side. So there's definitely some variability in the presence or the absence of these structures, but because we learn from a relatively decent sized population, we can actually find what they should be. And this is an interesting result in the area of the cingulum. So when I showed cingulum before, it was a purple C-shaped structure, and I showed all the clusters that make up the cingulum. So one advantage of using the clustering is that you can actually say we found that tractography very frequently breaks in the cingulum bundle. It doesn't really ever make it around this curve with the standard single tensor tractography. But we actually find multiple clusters, and this is just in the test data. This is not the training data. This is just the automatically segmented data. You can see that there were actually 6 clusters found within the cingulum region. And this is a more inferior cluster. This one is closer to the curve. And you can see that in each subject it's found these same clusters. And if you look at them across subjects, this is each row is a subject and each column is a cluster. You can see that there's some similarity across the subjects in the way the cingulum actually breaks, which I think is kind of interesting.
How do you get the coordinates for the test data from
I hurry through that part because I want to be able to get to the end. But by the coordinates, do you mean the coordinates in the embedding space?
Yes.
So from the affinity matrix, I use spectral clustering. So basically, it's the normalized cuts formulation. It's called simultaneous K-way normalized cuts. So basically, you take the eigenvectors of this affinity matrix, and you use the rows of the eigenvectors. It's equivalent to a projection onto the eigenvectors scaled by the divided by the eigenvalues.
This usually only applies to training data when you have the new data.
Yeah. Okay. So I skipped over that part because I wanted to get the results. So for the new data, it needs to be registered first to the mean FA image that's defining the coordinate system of the training data. And then next, for the Nystrom method, there were some number of trajectories that were randomly sampled to actually define this basis, this eigenvector basis. And so usually with 15 subjects, I probably use 2,000 or 3,000, for example, ballpark fibers. And so now the fibers in the new subject need to be compared to all those fibers. And then that gives for each new fiber a row of affinity values. And then you can just do the same projection. Yes.
So since we're talking about that.
Yeah, yeah, sorry. I hurried because I realized what time it is, and I thought I'd never make it to the end.
That is a dumb question.
No.
Since you have an affinity measure,
mm-hmm.
which is based simply on the euclidean distance, fibers, right?
Yeah, based on euclidean and distances between points on the fibers.
Yeah,
well, yeah, exactly.
That on some definition. Of
right. Sure.
Fibers. Why do you need the whole spectrum clustering machinery?
You mean why don't I just use?
You have a definition of the distance between two fibers.
Right.
Why don't you simply do k-means with that?
Well, you still can't directly do k-means on it. You'd still have to do, if you had all these pairwise distances, you still have to have a point set to do k-means on. So you still would have to use like multidimensional scaling or something to.
Right.
You have a distance, but
just one number.
But
so
k-means takes points in space. You could do some sort of hierarchical clustering, something that actually works on distances directly between. Yeah, you could use other clustering algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. With I implemented it this way because there was some prior work in our lab and it worked quite well. And the attractive thing about spectral clustering, I think, with this embedding is that first of all, your fiber is represented by this row, basically, this long list of affinities to all other fibers.
Mm-hmm.
And so then all of that information is taken into account in where it gets placed in this high-dimensional space. So it's not just simply how similar is it to one other fiber that you're making the clustering decision on. It's sort of using more information. And I think that's a good possibility. That's why it works better. But like I said, I haven't gone exhaustively tried to implement some hierarchical clustering method. I only did some experiments with it a couple years ago on small data sets. Yeah?
Can you comment, typically after you do the completion of the spectrum of the affinity operator, the higher line eigenvalues
mm-hmm.
are typically not really uniform. The spectrum of that operator normally has rather sharp decay. And can you comment on what you did for the whole spectrum, or did you use all of it?
Yeah, I didn't use all of it. So for the specific normalized cuts formulation that I'm using, the way the matrix is normalized, you throw out the first eigenvector because the row and column sums are approximately 1. So the first eigenvector is near constant. It's useless. And then as far as how many eigenvectors should you use after that, I did some experiments following the paper that introduced it. I can give you the reference later, but looking basically at the stability of the embedding space depending on the size of your A matrix is the size of the random sample you use for the Nystrom approximation, and I also repeated it depending on how many eigenvectors you used. In the test data set that I was using to do this, it came up as optimal to use 20 eigenvectors, and for a single subject, optimal to use like 1,500 or 2,000 as your Nystrom number that you randomly sample. So for those experiments, those were the optimal settings. Since then, since my thesis, I think it works just as well, if not better, to use 10-dimensional, to use 10 eigenvectors. Because the problem is if you use too many, you're basically putting noise into the system. But it's kind of complicated because the answer of does it work or not, you can say what's optimal according to some measure, but then you really have to look at the anatomy and see, well, does it actually find what I think it should be finding?
Did you look at the eigenvalues?
I didn't look very much at the eigenvalues because I read things saying that the eigenvalues were not useful as far as indicating where to cut things off for this type of clustering. It makes perfect sense. You think you should look at the eigenvalues. But then I read these counterexamples, and I thought, well, if it's already been proven wrong, I'm not going to put it in my thesis that I did it that way. Okay, so here's another example of something that you can do with the method, which is that you get many clusters. So you can say, I want a certain amount of subdivisions in the corpus callosum. You can assign clusters to those corpus callosum subdivisions, and then you get something like this. So finally, how many more minutes do I have? Like 3, 4?
Well, we can have a shorter break, maybe 5, 10 minutes.
Okay. Thanks, I'll try to hurry.
Sorry,
yes?
What is the, in the previous slide, what is the meaning of those subdivisions?
Well, these subdivisions, what is the meaning? That's a good question. What is the meaning of any corpus callosum subdivisions? There were initially, close to 20 clusters that were automatically found in the corpus callosum, which is dependent upon the number that I choose for K in the first place, which is how many clusters do I think are in the whole brain, which since running all these experiments, I came up with standard parameters that we use by default, and now for a single brain clustering, by default, we do 400 clusters, and that's from working with people who said, oh, but if I were using multiple ROIs, I really want this thing to separate out from that thing. So, but starting out with this, there were about 20 clusters, I think, in the corpus callosum, and I actually went visually and looked at it and combined clusters in order to make them be visually pleasing and specifically separate out. So there were, I think, 2 clusters in this yellow region that actually have these temporal lobe connections, and we clearly wanted those to be a different unit. But if you look at how people mostly do the corpus callosum subdivisions, it's something like, you know, a certain number of degrees here and millimeters here, and should they use straight up and down lines or lines that are sort of perpendicular? So I think the jury's still out on how to do it. I'm not claiming this is the best way. I should clearly go over it with someone who knows more neuroanatomy than I do to say how many subdivisions should we really use. But if that answers the
question, was basically whether
the question,
you reasonably think that there is a clusterization.
Yeah, I mean, it's known that there are regions in the corpus callosum that react differently to different disease states, but I don't know if it's known how finely should you subdivide it to get, say, the best p-values. That's the sort of thing I was getting. I didn't know what your question was.
Okay.
Yeah, but no, it's known that there are subregions. Okay, just very quickly go over some quantitative analysis. We're studying a little bit of handedness. We find that volumes of the arcuofasciculus are more or less symmetric dependent on handedness, a little bit of reliability versus the clustering and versus multiple region of interest. And this, I don't think I'll have much time to talk about it, but a lot of groups have been studying diffusion along tracts. I overdid it. Okay. A lot of groups lately. So we heard from Guido Gehrig about lots of really neat work that Casey Goodlett is doing. There's also Manaz Bada, who's just graduating from MIT, and there's a preliminary work of mine at Mackay last year. And so in order to study diffusion along tracts, as I was saying before, you first have to find the tracts, and then you have to decide some way to put a coordinate system on the tracts. So I think I'll just show one more slide about the coordinate system, about what I've been working on lately. Since I do this bilateral clustering, I can come up with bilateral fiber prototypes in both hemispheres, and I won't go into how I do that. what I'm doing experiments on, if you're starting with a prototype and deciding that the way you want to put coordinates on all of your subjects' fibers is starting from that prototype, what's a good way to do that? And I implemented a distance map method that was proposed by Mada et al., and it works decently, but you kind of get shocks in the arc length labeling. And so recently I've implemented another method based on optimal matching using the Hungarian algorithm, and with a cost function that basically penalizes you if you have matches between the prototype and the other fibers that are too far from perpendicular. So it's a little bit like the searching for a match that you've heard of with other algorithms like the tract-based spatial statistics and things like that. So finally, we can get some p-values. It's hard to say. Trying to be quick. Hard to say if they're real, but I have done experiments and they're at least consistent across size scales. Definitely have some lots of acknowledgments. Thank you, everybody. Oh.
Okay, there's time for a couple of questions.
Maybe you already asked already.
I still have one.
Okay.
Returning to the clustering, so you just
sure.
came in at the end, and this may be the factor that creates this multiple region in the corpus callosum.
What might be the factor?
When you use k-means.
Oh, why?
When you have some kind of slow varying,
right.
Continuously varying.
Yeah, the reason why I have the continuously varying, why it's not all the same, because clearly you could see that it looks like it could be all the same as they're slowly varying. The reason is really that I had this arbitrary choice of getting, for example, 400 clusters in the whole brain.
Mm-hmm.
So k-means, sure, it's going to find things that are actually different from your neighbors, but it's also going to parcellate everything
yeah,
that smoothly varies, which
a
actually is an attractive property, because
mm-hmm.
if it does it the same way across subjects, having additional subdivisions is no problem, because even if you don't want them subdivided within the atlas, you can just label them as all being the same structure. So if you want to treat them as the same structure, you can, or if you want subdivided regions for a study, that's good too. So I think it's an advantage. At first I wasn't sure that it was an advantage, but now that I've been using it, I think it's better this way.
And did you try some nonlinear method for projecting the data that would probably remove this kind of variation?
No, I haven't.
The way to restart
projecting which data? You mean embedding the data?
Yeah, for the embedding.
For the embedding, yeah, no, I haven't. I haven't done experiments with that. But if you have any references or anything, I'd be interested.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any more questions for Lauren? All right, well, thanks once again.